Well, hello, guys. Welcome to this bonus episode of Synchronize. And it's a bonus episode because we got the chance of talking to someone who's working for a company that we've discussed, I think, almost every episode of Synchronized. So we thought it would be great if they were willing to come and talk to us. I'm just going to read something from one of the press releases so you know what it's all about. Epidemic Sound, the market-leading platform for restriction-free music, is headquartered in Stockholm, heard around the globe, and on a mission to soundtrack the world. The company has democratized access to music for storytellers. Its innovative digital rights model paves the way for creators, everyone from YouTubers to small businesses to the world's largest brands, to use restriction-free music to take their content to the next level while simultaneously supporting the musicians it works with, both financially and creatively. That's a mouthful.
That's great.
That's a mission statement.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's great. It's a very good one. Yeah.
And the one to talk to us about Epidemic Sound is Niklas Brandberg. Thank you very much for joining us, Niklas.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Good, good. We normally start with just a simple question. How did you start your work life, and how do you end up in this business?
Yeah, sure. I like to introduce myself as kind of a failed musician. So I've always played music, and I really love playing music and experiencing in all kinds, all forms and shapes. I played in a bunch of bands in university and things like that, but I never really sort of took the professional route. I was never able to really make a living in music. But it's kind of full circle now for me, because I'm actually working with that mission still, but from a different side. After university, I studied business. I was part of a music tech startup already when I studied, but we actually, I used to tell the story when we received the first Spotify beta version, and I figured out, okay, well, our little startup's not gonna last for very long, which was true. So then I went into management consultancy and worked for Boston Consulting Group for a couple of years. In many different industries, quite a lot within media for broadcasters, but also within like sports and pharma and retail and things like that. But I wanted to go close to my passion and wanted to sort of join a company that had a real journey ahead of itself. I read about one of our co-founders, Oscar Höglund, and sent a cold email and said, this sounds cool. And we got in touch and I joined Epidemic 2014. Originally, I started working more on the sales and commercial side. So I was responsible for international sales with partnerships and opening up sales offices. But then I moved a bit close to music, started working with streaming partnerships. And then in 2019, I became chief of music focused. Since then, I've focused solely on the music side of Epidemic Sound.
So, Niklas, when was Epidemic founded then originally?
2009.
Okay.
I think when I joined, it was probably 10 to 15 people in 2014. And it's been growing quite a lot since then.
Because so how many people are working now for Epidemic?
I believe it's somewhere around between like 400 or 500 people, something like that.
And has it always been the same kind of strategy? You know, it's, you're working library music, that's your aim, or did it kind of move sideways from something else into that?
Well, in terms of the music, it's pretty much been the same. Like, we've been sort of building a catalog from day one and are doing that still. But I guess we've been changing focuses slightly from in terms of what clients we're working with. So originally it was very sort of broadcaster focused, working with this big in the early days, like the Nordic broadcasters and production companies. We still do that, but we've sort of broadened and working a lot more with, partly other sort of what we call like corporates or brands, people, the companies that might not be in media, but they still do a lot of media. And also what we call creators or storytellers. So individuals who are creating video for various types of platforms like YouTube or Twitch or Insta.
Right,
because that's an interesting thing. When you started, as you just mentioned, your main goal was broadcasters. Am I correct in that the idea behind Epidemic Sound was we're gonna offer a catalog to broadcasters where the music is not associated with a PRO, so the broadcaster doesn't have to pay performing rights. Was that the original idea?
I mean, that's part of it. So you could say, like, I mean, the company is founded by two groups. So two of them came from the broadcaster world. They ran a company called Zodiac Media, done a bunch of big international films and TV shows. And they were seeing that side of the problem, that sort of, it was tricky to use music. It was always, it led to issues. And music for them should be the most fun part of a production, but it often led to headaches. And that could be different things. It could be, it could be sort of that it becomes sort of really costly. It could be that there's some limitations on how it's supposed to be used, or confusion and reporting requirements and things like that. So they saw that issue. And then there was also two other co-founders from the music side that were music producers. And they saw the other side of the problem, which was that it's quite tricky to make a living in music. And they saw a lot of their friends and colleagues sort of not really being able to make a living and actually focus on the music. So they need to other things on the side. So they wanted to find like a new revenue stream for music creators. So those two groups got together and then figured out the Epidemic Sound business model. So that's kind of the origin of it.
So Nicholas, would you describe Epidemic as a publisher or a platform principally, or a hybrid of the two?
It's a good question. I mean, we like to simplify it and call ourselves like a music company, because in a way we're many different things. Our model is that we acquire 100% of the rights to the music. That sort of solves that first problem in a sense, because we're the only stakeholder involved. So we can sort of license music to users in a very easy way, and we can be very flexible. And since we're paying up front, we can also sort of, give some predictability to the music creators. But then we also have sort of a variable component in it, which I'll get to later, I suppose. Now I got confused now.
Are you a publisher?
Are you a publisher, really? Which we are.
Exactly. I would say we're probably both, you could consider us both a publisher and a record label and a platform, I would say. So I think we're sort of all three of those things. Because obviously we release all our music on the DSPs, on Spotify and Apple Music and Amazon as a label. And there we're both label and publisher. So we're kind of all of these things.
So you do all your catalog goes out for streaming as well then?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, 95% or so we release to streaming, yeah.
Because the interesting thing is that every time people talk about Epidemic in this podcast, it's always combined with the word disruptor. Do you consider yourself a disruptor?
I would say so. I mean, of course, things change. I think when we first came out, it was considered very disruptive because nobody had really that model, and there was quite a stir in the industry. I mean, now we're almost a teenager, so we've been around for almost 13 years now. So I guess the model is becoming, if you're a teenager in this world, I can't say we're that young anymore in a sense. But I think it is still a model that there's not many companies that's functioning in the exact same way. But then there are bits and pieces of what we do that other people do as well. So obviously we created a subscription for YouTubers originally in 2015 or so, which was sort of $15 a month for YouTubers to use music to the channel. And back then there were no subscription services, so very disruptive back then. Nowadays, I mean, there are other companies that have similar offerings, might not have the exact same offering in terms of the license and things like that, but still... So things are always happening in the industry, and you kind of gotta run to keep up in a sense.
So do you find yourself exchanging views with the traditional libraries, or do you feel you're on a kind of course in parallel to them or in opposition to them, or is it something? Because we all kind of talk, and you know, the traditional libraries, it's very much a kind of club in a way, which is partly our strength and partly our weakness, perhaps. So I wondered how you deal with Warner's and Universal and people.
I mean, we have sort of, I would say, friendly relationships, but I guess not too much interaction in that sense. So we try to really focus on some of our users and our music creator network, and but it's always fun to share experiences. I know you had Ori from Artlist there, and the show, and I listened to that one, and I mean, Ori came to our office a couple of years ago and had a visit, and we obviously we're competitors, but I think especially in the relationship towards music creators, there's so much you can sort of exchange ideas and figure out ways where all the companies in the industry can sort of improve. So I think we might compete for the users, but for the music creators, we're all kind of on the same mission, which I think is right. Which is great.
Yeah, excellent.
Okay, because that's an interesting thing. In the traditional production music industry, composers get paid also when music is being aired on television. That part doesn't exist within the Epidemic Sound business model, right?
To quickly explain how it works. So we have, we should say we have four components to how we pay music creators. So one is the upfront payment that I mentioned. So we pay, it's between $1,000 to $5,000 per track that we pay upfront. And that's really us sort of taking over the financial risk in a sense. So we pay them upfront. It might get used more than expected. It might get used less than expected, but we take over that risk. And then we have two sort of variable components in it. One being that we share, so we release everything to streaming platforms, and we share 50% of those revenues with all the music creators. So partly that's driven by just regular marketing of that music and trying to get it on playlists and things like that. But also, since the music gets played quite a lot in TV shows and on YouTube and on Instagram and things like that, it actually gets it gets heard and people want to hear it on the platforms as well. So it's like indirect marketing in a sense.
Yeah.
The third component is something what we call is the soundtrack bonus. So this year we have a sort of a $2 million pool that we then distribute depending on how popular the music is amongst our users. So I guess that's kind of the equivalent in a sense of sort of royalties in the traditional world. We have these variable components, and then the fourth one, which we just added, which we're really happy about, is that we're offering music creators to actually invest in the company as well. And obviously that's completely optional if they want to do that, but I think it's just nice to be able to offer that, and quite many have, which is really fun as well.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Okay, so just to wrap my head around these figures, if there's a composer who is writing 30 tracks per year for Epidemic Sound, he would get at least $30,000 a year.
Yeah, correct. That would be the case, yeah. So I think the average is somewhere around $40,000 a year or something like that. Depends on a bit sort of who you include in the average. But somewhere around there is the average earnings for a composer. But that would include then, you know, the different types of revenues that they would be getting. So some obviously, do many tracks. Some have success on streaming. Some have a success within our use for users. And some do well in all of them. And I guess those are very happy people.
Okay. And you, Epidemic Sound, does not collect any income from PROs around the world?
No, so we're not members of any PROs around the world. When we license the music for like audiovisual use, that license includes, all the publishing rights. So also the public performance rights, for example. So we don't collect anything on that. When it comes to streaming, I mean, we own both the publishing and the masters. So we collect all of that as well. And pay that out 50% to the creators.
How does that work in practical terms, Nicholas, that the PROs don't send you money? I mean, how do they know that your tracks they don't need to pay you for? Is it kind of like negative registration, or I'm fascinated?
I don't exactly know how the PROs do it, to be honest. But obviously we need to collect. If we can make direct deals with platforms and collect that money directly, that's great. Sometimes we need to use intermediaries to assist us. But yeah, I don't really know how it works on the PRO side, to be completely blunt.
Do you get much feedback from them? I mean, what do they think of your business model? Because you're cutting them out, they probably don't like it, I suppose.
We obviously keep in touch with especially the Swedish PROs, because we have still, I mean, we have a roster both in Sweden and the US, but I guess we're mostly in contact with the Swedish ones given the history. But I think we have a pretty friendly relationship nowadays. I think there was more heated discussions earlier on when we sort of just entered the arena. But it's quite common for people to, people, if they work with us, they obviously need to leave the societies, but they want to leave on good terms. And the societies are relatively helpful in that change, because obviously some people might want to go back to the societies at a later point in their careers. So it's important that we have a sort of good relationship, I think.
Well, that's a good point you're making, because one of the questions that came in through Facebook was, why do your composers have to be unaffiliated with a PRO?
So, I mean, that sort of goes back to what we're trying to achieve for the users. So we want to make it... we want a license that's completely restriction-free. So royalty-free is a quite common word in the industry, but it's not 100% royalty-free in a sense, because there might be other types of rights you need to clear, like the public performance right, for example. So we have a license that's we call it restriction-free, so that we can offer it restriction-free on depending on geography, a platform, time, shouldn't be reporting, shouldn't be in sort of an unexpected cost. So given that, we believe that we needed to be the sole owner of all the rights. And in order to do that, we would need to stay out of the collecting society system. Because if someone is a member of a collecting society, most societies have an exclusivity principle in that they can't sell music while they're a member and keep that out of the society. So it's kind of that exclusivity requirement makes it that they actually have to leave the society to work with us.
Nicholas, are people able to sort of be members of PROs under their real name and then use a pseudonym and work with you? I mean, is that something that happens, or is it that again?
No, so it's like the physical people that we're signing agreements with. So they physically need to leave. And it's quite important, because when things go wrong there, if you mess up on a date or something, it could have an impact on users. So we need to be very careful and making sure that, either if you're working with us, we need to make sure that they're not members during that time.
So looking at my roster of composers for Music for Sport, most of them will be writing for us, writing for other libraries, but they'll also be writing music for TV and film and stuff, where they will need to be members of PROs to collect what's rightfully theirs. So does that mean to some extent, your writers are totally loyal to you, because essentially they can't work outside your box because they won't be allowed to? I mean, it's all new stuff to me, so it's very interesting.
Sure. I mean, it's up to every music creator, really, like what... And some of them need to make trade-offs when they work with us, and need to sort of, make a judgment if that potential revenue that they might be giving up is worth it to join us during a period.
Are you aware of film companies and TV companies that work in the same way that you do? They take 100% and they pay the composer a lot more, as you do. So are there other sort of people using in different areas of the business using your business model?
I'm not fully I can't say I know the details of those types of deals, but obviously sort of read things about these deals, I guess especially in the US where it functions like that. So it's, I guess it's parallels, but I don't really know the details of like how they actually treat the creators and if they're actually getting like fairly paid, which is something that's obviously super important for us and getting even, constantly getting even more important now with the new EU director, for example, which is great that sort of comes into the light. So I don't really know. I can't really comment on those types of deals. But what I can say is that like we're not, apart from this, obviously this collecting society restriction that we talked about, we're not exclusive in any other way. So a lot of people still do things on the side, and they could release music on other labels that they can monetize via streaming, for example, write custom compositions and things like that. So a lot of people are not 100% epidemic. They still do other things on the side.
So what if you took a young writer and you gave them lots of opportunities and they became quite famous, and then Steven Spielberg comes along and says, you know, I want you to do my new film. And he comes to you and says, right, she says, look, I need to join a PRO in order to get, this is my big break. So how would you adapt to that? Would you take all their back catalogue off, or, I mean, get them to pay you back their original down payments? How would that all work? Or would you just say no?
So first of all, I think we'd be pretty proud if Steven Spielberg came. I mean, that would be a great opportunity for that person. But no, we would, so we typically sign like 3 months agreements. So they're short. So when they, if you need to get out quickly, I think that would be possible too. So they would typically leave Epidemic then and enter the society. But it's just then the music that they've written for us is, we still own that music. So even though they become members, their music that they sold to us is still outside of the society world.
Right. Yeah, I understand. Yeah,
that works pretty well, actually.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. Listening to this story, it's interesting because you said that a couple of the founders of Epidemic Sound came from the broadcast industry. Mm-hmm. And they probably had discussions and negotiations with PROs and thought, my God, this is so annoying. Because I think the PROs, they think in all the things that are not possible. They're trying to make people, they make it as difficult as possible to make money. It's very difficult for composers to get money. It takes a long time. Do you think that combination led to this business model?
I think it was definitely a factor in the origins of it. I think it was worse back then, like before, you know, 28 or so or 29 when they started thinking about this, because I heard stories a lot about the reporting. The reporting's gotten better, but back in the day it was a lot of, you know, physical sheets of reporting and having interns trying to fill that out, and obviously the composers didn't always get what they were supposed to get. So there's a lot of these factors and anecdotes that played into it, I believe, wanting to sort of create a new model that's functioning in a different way. But obviously, I think since then the traditional world or traditional music world has also improved. So obviously, it's there's been improvements since then as well.
You have a business background. Were you guys looking at the traditional production music industry and think, wow, this is a business model that's broken, that doesn't work anymore? We can do better?
I think not fully broken in that sense, but more especially when moving online, like moving to a global world, moving to where sort of you can't really restrict the usage to like a single geography or a single platform or things like that. I think they saw that sort of, okay, it's very complex in the old world when you want something that's truly global without any issues. And people were almost like looking for like an insurance, like, can I use this track? I don't want any trouble. I just want to use music for the video. And I think that was sort of the wanting to serve that brought them to it. Yeah.
So what do we need to do to be able to compete with you?
It's a good question. I mean, don't do it too well. I have a belief in that sort of the production music industry is just really, it's in a good place. I mean, because like all the macro trends are pointing in the right direction. So like there's going to be more and more video going to be produced. There's going to be more on platforms. There's going to be the quality will be going up of content production and also then of the music, because that needs to match. So there's a lot of like directions or arrows pointing in the right direction. I think what's key is sort of the convenience, in the sense that the people using the music, they want to be able to find it easily. They want to be able to use it without having to worry, because a lot of the, I think historically, music users and music editors, they were a bit more aware of like the music rights situation. Even though it's complicated, they probably knew a bit more about it. I think nowadays and going forward, it's going to be users that don't really understand it. So they might not know if they're doing something wrong or not. So just like simplifying and making it really easy for the user is like, that's like our mantra. And I can't say specifically what that means for other companies in the industry, but I think that's a good to keep in mind.
So you said that you started off sort of tackling broadcast, and then you became more for user generated content, and that's where you're principally sort of known at the moment. Do you have your eyes on all the broadcasters of the world that you think they could similarly appreciate the more simplified version that you're doing? Do you think that's attractive to the BBC, to the Dutch broadcasters and things, or do you think they're going to be very conservative and stick to their old models?
I think it's going to be a mix. Like we still have we have broadcaster clients in quite many countries. Mm-hmm. I think and hope that more and more will sort of appreciate our model as well. But I don't think a broadcaster would necessarily want just one or the other. I think they would want to use sort of commercial music or some music from the traditional world to some extent. And I think Epidemic Sound music would be very useful to some extent as well. So I think like for those types of producers that do so much content, I think it makes sense to be able to not have to choose path. They can use both.
And do you have an established blanket deal for broadcasters like you do for user-generated clients, or is that something you talk about in terms of scale of the companies and things?
Yeah, that's more in terms of scale. So we got two sort of online products, one for the individual creators, mm-hmm. And then one which is a little bit more expensive for what we call a business plan. But that's still with some limitations in terms of like it's only one seat, kind of one login and things like that, so it's a bit limited. And then for larger clients like broadcasters or brands, that's a deal per deal type of thing.
You're a head of music. Can you tell me what it entails? What are you doing on a daily basis?
So I oversee everything in the value chain of starting with the sort of the analysis of what do our users need? What kind of music do they need? What kind of music do we need to be able to attract new users as well? And then we just sort of match that with our roster. And when we have gaps, saying, okay, well, we need cumbia music. We don't really have anyone that can do that. So then we need to do some scouting to find that music creator. And then once we have them, or if it's music that we already have in our roster, we have a team of A&Rs that work closely with the music creators, gives them feedback on the music coming in, and sort of helping them to sort of grow and develop as music creators. Then once we have the music pieces finalized, there's obviously a component of, partly making sure that we have all the paperwork in place as well, which is obviously key for working in a corporate industry, but also the metadata tagging. So making sure that we tag everything in the best way possible, so it's discoverable by the users. Because I think that the being able to find it in a seamless way is so important. And then that all starts with the tagging, to have accurate tags and tags in the way that the users that fits with the way they're thinking. And then the last step is the sort of the distribution. So obviously pushing it out to our users and our partners, and then pushing out to streaming platforms as well, and making sure that it gets, that listeners can find it as well.
Synchronized is sponsored by Ames, an AI-based music similarity search created by seasoned production music insiders. Ames has also launched auto tagging, so visit amesapi.com to get 100 tracks tagged for free.
So, Nicholas, do you provide the production facilities for the composers? Do they come to you with manuscript paper and then you give them musicians and studios, or do they tend to come with a finished product?
So they have their own studios. Right. We have some studios at our place, but that's mostly for sort of review and for if you want to do maybe some collabs or do some sessions or things like that. But typically they work from their own studios, but are in constant contact with this A&R that they have. So every music creator has their A&R that they're in touch with.
So obviously you're quite strict about who you choose because you're paying them up front. It's not a question of try people out, and if it doesn't work, you know, you need to believe that this person's going to be worth initially $1,000 for a track. So that's the A&R department, is it? And the scouting, that happens at that point?
Yes.
And so then how do you give the company a kind of overall sound, or you're not aiming for a kind of epidemic sound? Is there a particular kind of feel to an epidemic track or a sound to it?
I mean, ideally, we'd want to avoid that in a sense,
okay.
Having the catalog with a specific sound. Obviously, we want it to sound really good and have high quality and sort of be known for that. But our mission is to sort of, as you mentioned in the beginning, soundtrack the world. So we need to be very broad and sort of have a lot of variety and diversity in the catalog. So I think that's one of our biggest, challenges now and going forward to, because I think we have a good catalog, but it's, I think it can get more diverse, more different sort of niche genres from around the world and things like that. And that's sort of the challenge to find these people that can do these other styles of music that might not be sort of as common here in Northern Europe and in the US, where we're mostly based.
Right.
In a former episode of Synchronized, we had Julia and Toby as guests. They are PhD candidates, and they are looking into the data metrics of production music. They are very eager to find big data on why is a certain track popular. Is it because of the tagging? Is it because of the music? I'm pretty sure you run analysis like that. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
We look at several different sort of aspects of how a track gets, partly how it gets discovered, in a sense, like how when people come to our player and they wanna start like a search journey, in a sense. They choose different starting points. Some are looking for maybe a certain mood, some for a different genre, some for search for like keywords, and then we're trying to track like, okay, well, are they reaching success with these different entry points and finding the music that they're looking for? So obviously that's like a very important for us. Then in terms of slicing and dicing the catalog in different ways, and looking if we can find insights or patterns. You can slice it on different, obviously, sub-genre levels, mood levels. Does it have vocals? Does it not have vocals? What's the energy level? So we try to look at different kind of dimensions in order to figure out what works, what doesn't work. But then, to be honest, it's not the science either. So we can sort of get signals from data in that sense. But then a lot of the times tracks get really popular and we don't really know why. And it's the same in the commercial world, why some tracks get super viral. And it's the same within our catalog as well, why certain tracks get super popular amongst certain video creators. So I think it's like combining both like the creative sense and listening to people using it and then also looking at the data and see if we can find some patterns. So I guess that's the tricky part of music, that it's not only black and white. It's a lot of nuances in it.
So Nicholas, if you've got a track that you think, oh, it's a great track and it's just not performing, would you go and then change the data? Is that something you might look at? I mean, do you constantly change data? If you've got an Olympics come up, do you put Olympics across your sports tracks or Winter Olympics? Is that sort of evolving all the time, the data, or is it static once you've released a track?
Once we released like a piece of work, we don't sort of alter that.
Right.
But it could be, we could create a different version of it, of course. That happens from time to time.
Yeah.
But typically that insight might feed into future productions. And maybe a specific music creator can learn from something. That track didn't really work out, and why not? And then we can, the A&R and the music creator can talk about that and try to figure it out. I also think like a catalog is also interesting because that's like an organism in itself. And even though some tracks and some genres might sort of inevitably always be more popular, I think tracks that are in different niches and might not have such a big audience, they still have a very big value to us because we want this diverse catalog. And if you're looking for a certain genre or style, you should be able to find that too, even though, and that's super valuable then if they find that and get that golden moment of, yes, I found a track I'm looking for, even though that track might not get as much usage as others. So it's like, yeah, it's a... Yeah, it's a balancing act in a sense of what we choose
to be sure, Niklas, you can't give us now a formula to write successful music.
Unfortunately not. If yeah, that would be amazing.
Okay, that's
but don't you have that? I thought you had it.
No, he's keeping it to himself, Niklas. He won't give that one away. So, Niklas, how big is the catalog at the moment?
So it's just north of 35,000 tracks.
And do you have, is that tracks or versions included in that?
That's tracks. There might be some versions in that, but not very many. But then what would you do, like, you know, clean versions, explicit versions? We do instrumental versions of tracks with vocals, and then the number becomes bigger. But so 35 unique pieces of music.
So in the traditional library business, library music was instrumental. Obviously, you do vocal tracks. So, what percentage of your tracks could you tell us are vocal, and what percentage are instrumental?
Yeah, sure. So, it would be I would say like 80-90% ish. I would say are instrumental tracks, somewhere around there, and then the rest are vocals. Yeah.
And your vocals, would you tend to do an English version, a Swedish version, a French version, a German version, or would you just see how that goes?
Mostly we've done sort of the language of the original track in a sense. So a lot of it is in English, but obviously we do a lot of Latin music as well. So there's some Spanish and some Portuguese, and there's a couple of Swedish tracks, not very many. So we haven't done that many of this sort of reversioning, but something that we're experimenting a bit with, and we'll see.
So that. To be honest, that's quite surprising. I thought you'd have more tracks than that. Obviously, you know, that's where you're at the moment. How does that, do you mind me asking, how that equates to a valuation of 1.4 billion? What have you got up your sleeve that's that makes sense of that?
Yeah, so I would say that our company is not, I think it consists of three main parts. And I think that's what makes it really interesting. So one part is obviously the music in itself and that catalog. Yeah. That's obviously the key component of it. Four parts. And the second one, we sort of the rights of that music, which is different from other catalogs. So I think that holds a value in itself. The third piece then would be the actual product and sort of the Epidemic Sound player that we call it, sort of where people are discovering the music. So we invest a lot in that and have, you know, machine learning solutions for serving personalized recommendations to users it's a lot of sort of innovation ongoing in that arena, and that's a big part of it as well. And the fourth one then I would say is the sort of the user network. So obviously having a really wide range of users also adds to the value of the company and sort of the business model in itself and being sort of having a large share of recurring users that are sort of sticking with us.
So your valuation puts you up there with the majors, really, doesn't it? With Universal and people. But you look at Universal, they've got 500,000 tracks. It's kind of, you're obviously, part of your mission is to get a bigger number of tracks. But the problem is you can't do what the Universal business model would be, go and buy other labels, because they don't fit your brief, do they, with their business model? So you have to generate all your material. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the great part and the tricky part with my job. So we need to sort of function in a specific way, and we need to produce. Yeah, we can't take any shortcuts in that sense.
Right.
But we're getting there. So obviously we're working with hundreds of music creators and adding sort of hundreds of tracks every month. So it's increasing, and it's a lot of fun to produce new music, as you both know.
Yeah, and well, you've got a great war chest as well to kind of dig into. If you need to spend a bit of extra, you've got it, haven't you? So you haven't got a boss saying, sorry, we can't afford that orchestra. I mean, you've got it if you need it, yeah?
Yeah, it's my boss's biggest problem then.
Spending the money.
No, just kidding.
Do you consider yourself like a business-to-consumer company or a business-to-business company?
So I would say both. So we definitely cater to both types. So we like to say like business to creator, and then that creator could be an individual, or it could be, you know, large ad agency or broadcaster. Yeah.
Because you also offer services, as I understood, where people can use your catalog as background music in restaurants, bars.
Yeah, exactly. So we have sort of an app called Epidemic Spaces that has that type of service where you can sort of stream the music in the background, and it's using the same catalog as we do for storytellers. So that's part of it too. But I would say our focus lies more within the storyteller landscape.
Just a bit of insight. When you look at the landscape of visual streaming services, there's a plethora of them, Disney, Prime, etc. Do you think that's going to come down? Or, I mean, are you happy to deal with all 10 or whatever? Or do you think it's going to narrow down? There's going to be some sort of massive battle that ends in perhaps YouTube beating the lot of them out of the block. How do you see it going?
It's a good question. I mean, I think there's not going to be one winner, I don't believe, but there's probably going to be a few big ones. I mean, obviously Netflix and HBO are huge. Disney's doing really well. And I think if we look at the music streaming side as well, it's similar. Like you have the big five or six platforms that are really outperforming the smaller ones, and then there's a couple of challengers that might get up there. Some type of consolidation and a set of 5-6 big ones is likely where we'll see it end up. But who knows?
So, and do you, as memory size is less and less important? You know, we've gone from small MP3s now to typically in library music we use 48K, 24-bit WAVs. As things change, we might end up doing 96K or anything we can imagine. We might end up 5.1. I mean, where do you see it all going? Do you see the quality increasing constantly, or do you think we kind of reach a plateau?
That's a good question. We actually just recently had a workshop with a producer here in Sweden who did some Dolby Atmos mixes of some of our tracks, and great to listen to. So we went to the studio the other, you know, just a couple days ago and listened to those. And he tried, you know, he talked through all the different formats. Obviously that, if you're sort of at the highest level of sort of enrichment in terms of the audio, that can then obviously translate to many different formats. I definitely don't have the answer to it. I believe there's going to be some kind of enrichment into the audio, and that the format's likely going to change, but I don't.
So how about?
I think it might depend on the use case as well. Like obviously Netflix might have that as a standard on YouTube. Probably not so much now, but I think it could trickle upwards in terms of how sort of rich the metadata within the tracks are.
So the Facebook metaverse is going to be virtual, right? So
yeah.
In a sense, the requirement of the sound, even if not the music, will be need to be surround, perhaps left, right, back, front, but perhaps up, down as well. And if that's the case, then why shouldn't the music be doing, you know, similar things?
Yeah. I think we will go in that direction. I just don't really know
when.
Would be the exact format to be the one sort of leading the charge. So I think it's good to be sort of open and experiment a bit and see what happens. But it's super exciting. It's fun to listen to, and I guess it all depends on. I think it depends on like how users adapt to it, and I think it needs to be integrated into speakers and headphones without actually the end user noticing or even having to pay for it, because I don't think someone would want to pay additional to get so compatibility with a different format. But if the manufacturers are kind of putting it in there without even telling us, I believe it will prevail, sort of a different, more enriched format in the end. What do you guys have? Have you had any guests discussing the different formats? Because it's obviously very interesting.
No, not yet.
No,
not yet.
No, you're the first. No. I mean, my experience, Nicholas, is, you know, as a composer, that I've several times keyed up my studio for 5.1 for television and found very little pickup for it, that you know, more that the editors would want stems and then they can put it where they want rather than you say that the guitar wants to be at the back. I mean, so... A, I think visual media can be quite conservative compared to us, who the music business, who are essentially, we love toys, we love the latest thing. That's kind of partly what drives us. So I think it's kind of you go up a bit, you push, and then you kind of go back a bit, and you slowly you're going uphill, but it's kind of up down really. And I think we will be led by the metaverse. I think that's probably the biggest, if that works, that whole thing of virtual. Virtual reality needs, in my experience, because I've experimented with it, does need more than stereo music to make it really glue together.
It's a good thing that in Holland we have a solution to turn your whole back catalog into whatever you want. It's called marijuana. You know, it works all the time.
That's a good one. I was thinking, like, what company is that? That sounds amazing. I need to get in touch.
Exactly,
Buy shares in that one.
I've got a question for you, Nicholas. As a traditional publisher, we're always interested in where our music's being aired, right? So we work with fingerprinting system, Content ID on YouTube. Is that technology that you use for tracking your music?
Yes, absolutely. So Content ID, yes, and different fingerprinting services as well, to get an understanding of how it gets spread. So it's obviously, that's interesting data, and it's interesting to combine that with, you know, what's being what music's being downloaded a lot in our player versus what's music actually being aired, because obviously that's the gap in our understanding, because people might download 10 tracks and they might only use one.
So you don't use it to optimize your income from PROs because you don't have that segment.
Yeah, so it's more for understanding, really. Yeah.
Nicholas, we've been looking for analogies that sort of talk about our business model against yours, and one of them we came up with was that we're all producing petrol cars. You know, they're very refined, we've been doing it for years, they're beautiful things, and you guys are making electric cars. And the fact of the matter is that the electric car is going to beat the petrol car because it's more right for now, it's more in sync with the world. Do you think that's a good analogy? I mean, do we need to start building electric cars to kind of match you, or to kind of keep in the same universe as you, or is it just not a good analogy?
I don't know. I think the petrol cars would probably be around for some time still, obviously. So I think that's good. But that's, you know, obviously we want to move to electrical as soon as possible. But I think it's important, given how the landscape of the users is changing so much, that if you're sort of supplying them with something, that you sort of try to stay very close to it and try to change with them. And I think our point of view is that our model makes it easier for us to adapt to the user landscape. But I wouldn't say it's impossible to do that, even though you're in a traditional model. But I think it might be... There are some limitations there that makes it a bit trickier, but obviously we have some limitations as well, given our model. So there's a bit of give and take.
So a lot of our listeners will be traditional libraries. I mean, they'll be looking for reassurance, really, that you're not going to wipe them out. So can you give us that, or is that really inevitable?
We're very ambitious in the sense that we want to grow a lot. We want to grow to, you know, different types of users and different geographies and things like that. So obviously we're very ambitious. But I guess the biggest reassurance is that the market is growing a lot as well. So if you position yourselves well in this market, I think it's a good place to be. We're not going to slow down, if that's the question.
Okay.
Are you also thinking about moving into pictures, like video, stock video?
Not in the plans right now. No. So I mean, yeah, some companies have been doing that, and I think I mean that it makes sense. It's obviously a tangent to what we do, but our focus is really on the music and how can we be the best possible music provider for storytellers and video creators. So that's our sort of 100% focus on.
And Nicholas, do you have any? I've looked at your team, and you've got very interesting people from tech. You know, different areas of tech. You've obviously got really kind of good stuff coming from there. Do you have any traditional music library executives who've joined you, who to kind of give you the lay of the land as it used to be?
Good question. I need to think a little bit, but not really from the production music world. I mean, we have a lot of people from the music industry. Sure. I mean, obviously people who's you know, been producers or been composers or been artists or been working for labels, and I think we have some people that has worked for collecting societies. Mm-hmm. But maybe not sort of the typical production music catalog. I might be wrong, but we have a pretty big, yeah, it's a pretty nice mix of people from that has experienced the music industry from very different angles. And then there's a lot of people from the tech world, and a lot of other people too. So, really try to add different things to the culture and add different skills to the team's expertise, which I think has been good.
So, Nicholas, talk to me about diversity in your company. One of the things we do talk to on the podcast is the lack of diversity amongst composers. The obvious one being there are way more men than women composing library music. That's obviously something you've spotted and identified. Are you able to do something about that? Is that a deliberate tactic?
Yeah, it's a pretty big focus area in terms of, especially in terms of scouting for new creators. Currently, if we look at producers and composers as one group, we're currently at about 1 out of 4 that are non-male. And I mean, it wasn't that long ago that the ratio was sort of 1 out of 10 for us. So we've sort of, we're moving in the right direction, but obviously, you know, still some time to go until it's 2 out of 4 instead of 1 out of 4. Yeah, big focus area, and obviously, yeah, definitely a big problem in the industry, that it's very sort of male dominated. Yeah. But we're working, and also in terms of like other aspects of diversity, ethnicity and things like that. So we're trying to really search in diverse populations with sort of being really active on the scouting end, and also been working a lot with trying to be like when we make decisions for who to sign, make sure that we're really unbiased in a sense that we don't really know who we're sort of scoring when we're looking at submissions and potential people that we would sign. And I would say being part of an underrepresented group is an advantage in the sense that it adds to the diversity and the variety of the catalog, regardless of sort of underrepresented group.
Are your users equally balanced?
We don't really know. Don't think we collect that data in terms of like gender, for example.
Yeah.
I might be wrong, but I don't think we totally know that.
So, interesting. Yeah.
It's a good question.
Sorry.
Do you have multiple offices around the world?
Yes. So we have a main office in Stockholm. We got two offices in the US, so LA and New York. We got a smaller office in Korea, and we got some people in Hamburg and Amsterdam as well, actually. But quite small there. So the main operations is US and Sweden.
So nothing.
What kind
London
of people
yet?
Do you have in those places? Is that salespeople or?
So in Sweden and US, it's a little bit of every. Sweden's obviously all different kinds of roles. In the US, it's sales and marketing and music. So we're not at half yet, but soon I would expect soon that half our music roster is based in the US. A large part of my team is based in the US, and then in the other offices it's more on the commercial side, so sales, marketing, partnerships, that kind of stuff.
So I interrupted. Nothing in London yet.
Nothing in London yet. But we got quite a lot of clients there, and And I guess the salespeople and the partnership people need to go there quite a bit. But we'll see. We'll see if we need to open up there.
Yeah.
I think we're almost running out of time. So I just want to ask one final question from my point of view. You're a disruptor in the production music industry. When are we going to see a disruptor in the performing rights organizations?
That's a good question. I don't. I mean, probably quite soon. In a sense, like there's definitely been some organizations that have sort of been making moves and trying to do things a bit differently. So I think that's sort of a constant. There'll be constant development there, and I believe like it feels like the collecting societies around the world are sort of being more and more innovative, which is good. I mean, here in Sweden, we got the Cora Music Service, which is sort of, they've called it the epidemic killer. I know, but
you're laughing about it, right?
Well. I don't know that much about how the service is going. It's a funny phrase, but I think. The disruption in the industry is good because it sort of pushes people and organizations to do innovative things. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot more innovation in the industry as a whole.
So I mean, the original disruptor in our business was Audio Network, but you've disrupted Audio Network. So you're expecting obviously people to come and disrupt your business model, and that's inevitable. So but the question everybody would ask is that not just a race to the bottom? And at some point, is the ultimate disruptor going to be somebody who says, look, all our music's free, and yet they make all their money from advertising or some kind of off the ball activity. So, do you fight off disruptors? Do you buy them? Do you kill them? I mean, how do you deal with them?
I mean, I think the best way to fight off disruptors is to sort of stay really innovative and really sort of keep pushing the envelope. So, I think that's the main strategy in that world. And as to sort of the race to the bottom, I don't believe that will happen because like. If companies don't treat the music creators in a good way, then they're not going to be able to have a catalog and have a service that's of high quality. So it's kind of, that's like the control mechanism in a sense. Like if you don't have if you're not paying people fairly, not treating people fairly, they're not going to want to work with you, and then you're not going to have anything to sell. So I think that should control itself. But I'm certain there's going to be a lot of innovative companies trying to disrupt, and we just need to, even though we've grown a bit, we need to sort of stay disruptive, stay innovative, which is, I guess, any challenge for a company kind of of our size.
I think that's a great conclusion, by the way, that you have to value the creator, because otherwise this industry wouldn't exist.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I just ask one quick last question, Ferry?
Sure.
Just, Nicholas, could you think of anybody, or perhaps you can let us know at another point, of another good guest that you could suggest for our podcast who would add to the debate?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I thought of one because I asked the question. I got to the question just before, but then when we're speaking here, it would be interesting to hear someone, now that we're talking about sort of the different formats of music and different. I think that's sort of someone with some really good experience and insight into. Different, like the Dolby Atmos and sort of spatial audio, and that topic would be super interesting. I don't know any people specifically there. But the other person I thought about was actually a person called Lee Jin, who's sort of an entrepreneur, but also sort of does a lot of writing, a lot of like thought pieces, but more looking at sort of from the creator side, like talking a lot about the creator economy. And I think that would be interesting. I don't know her, but I think it would be interesting to sort of pick her brain on, what the development in the creator economy could mean for the music industry and the production music industry. So I think that could be a very interesting person.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Nicholas. It was great having you as a guest.
Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great talking to you. And you're welcome to... invite me again at some point if you have more questions.
I think we should do that.
Sounds great. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you.